Welcome to Because the Beatles, the podcast about the Beatles, everything about the Beatles 24/8. I'm Allison.
And I'm Erica. And before we start, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or stream us on Spotify. And if you're enjoying BC the Beatles, feel free to leave us a preferably five-star review so other Beatlemaniacs can find us.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter/X, TikTok, and also YouTube. We'll be posting videos, photos, and more from this episode and beyond. And you can also email us at bcthebeatles@gmail.com.
So today we have something a little different for you. I was recently a guest on the podcast We Say Yeah, which is a show all about Cliff Richard and the Shadows. This is one of the only, if not the only, podcast exclusively about Cliff Richard, who was, of course, a huge success in the UK and a contemporary of the Beatles. Cliff is, of course, very well known to British audiences. His 65-year career has touched on every music genre and performing arts medium out there. And like Paul and Ringo, he's one of the few musical artists to have been knighted. But he's not quite as well known outside of the UK. So a little bit about the podcast. Cliff Richard and the Shadows dominated the British pop and rock music world from 1958 to 1963 and weathered the storm of Beatlemania to continue to release hits for years to come. Many were even recorded in Studio 2 at Abbey Road, and they wrote a lot of their own material. Although pre-Beatles British rock and roll music is largely ignored by American rock historians, the We Say Yeah podcast has spent nearly 3 years reviewing every single EP and LP released by Cliff and the Shadows, either together or apart, in chronological order. Hosted by David Ghosty Wills, former Sirius XM DJ and cartoon voice actor, each month's episode features the host and a guest not only reviewing records, but also venturing into sidebar discussions about popular music of the era, the film and television industry in Europe, and so much more. And in addition to hosting We Say Yeah, David has been a Beatles fan since the age of 12, but came in through Paul McCartney's solo career, which he says he loves more than anything else on earth. Oh, I feel you there. He became a fan of Cliff Richard through his early 80s US hits, and then he discovered an album of his 60s hits. The excerpt from We Say Yeah that we're featuring today is from actually my third appearance on this show. In this episode, we're discussing the movie musical Wonderful Life, which opened in the UK on July 2nd, 1964, a mere 4 days before the premiere of A Hard Day's Night. Despite the close release dates and the fact that they both star the UK's top two musical acts of the day, the similarities end there. Wonderful Life is unlike anything else. Unlike Hard Day's Night, it's shot in color, and it contains elements of MGM-style movie musicals. It's got a wild plot that has to be seen to be believed, and it has more location and costume changes than even the Beatles got away with when they filmed Help. And there's even a 20-minute montage detailing the entire history of film up through 1964. And with Cliff and the Beatles being so related in British music history, the Beatles pop up in this conversation quite a few times. I always have a great time on the We Say Yeah podcast, and we hope you'll enjoy this excerpt. We've dropped links in the show notes to follow the full podcast and also to listen to the soundtrack of Wonderful Life if you're intrigued. Enjoy!
You know, it's funny. I thought that really the only news to discuss would be the anniversary of the Beatles arriving in America. And yet, we just got word about this upcoming movie directed by Sam Mendes, or four movies. It's the story of the Beatles from four different perspectives. I don't know if it's going to be the entire career of the Beatles or just one event from four different perspectives, but what did you think about this news?
Oh, I was so excited about this. First off, Sam Mendes. I'm not a huge film person, but I am a huge musical theater person. And Sam Mendes is huge in musical theater. He directed this production of Cabaret at the Donmar Warehouse in 1993 with Alan Cumming and Natasha Richardson in Broadway. It was a groundbreaking production. It reset how this show was seen in popular culture, how people mounted it in local productions. And, you know, he's kind of a hero in that community for that. I mean, so well known. So when I heard about this, you know, I actually haven't seen a lot of the movies that I know he's famous for, but I was really excited to see somebody with this sense of theatricality, understanding how to direct musicals, musicians, and songs, and, you know, to work with deep subjects in a very sensitive way. So I'm super excited about it. As far as the four movies are concerned, you know, it's interesting. I think the question really is among the people I know of talking about this. Is it really four movies? Is this a four and done project? Or are we talking about the launch of the Beatles cinematic universe here?
Ooh.
Because it could be.
It could.
We don't know.
Sure.
We don't know. But that lets a lot of us be very excited, very, very excited about what could possibly be coming out of it, even beyond the four movies.
We could call it the BCU.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. And in fact, I think there's plenty of room for not only Cliff in there, but, you know, maybe storied nemesis George Martin and Nori Paramore could have some kind of face off, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Like Professor X and whatever his name was, Magneto.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking last night.
That brings us to our main attraction, which is the movie, well, the soundtrack to the movie, Wonderful Life, released in July of 1964.
His 23rd birthday and Susan Hampshire helping him to celebrate it. Who wouldn't be Cliff Richard? She is to co-star with Cliff in his third big musical, Wonderful Life. He's following up The Young Ones and Summer Holiday, and no doubt the third film will repeat their success.
A movie that I lent you.
I've watched it twice.
Oh, my goodness. talk about dedication. Yeah, it's an unusual film.
Now, you gave me some very good advice before I started watching the film. That was to watch this film in two parts, because it is, the plot is bonkers. It's all over the place. And I did have to watch it twice. The second time, I did follow what they were doing.
Yes.
But the way that the story resolves itself in the end, I don't know if you want to go through exactly what this plot is, or if it's too long for any sane listener to sit through.
No, go right ahead.
In the end, basically, there are two conflicting movies that are being shot. One is the main movie, and one is being shot in secret behind the scenes, and the two directors just find out that they really only have each half of a good movie. So their amazing solution is to somehow edit these two together, even though they each have two different leading men. So the problem is solved by them deciding, well, she'll just have two leading men who are brothers, and that will solve the problem. Yeah. I don't even know if our AI capabilities now could put two movies together and make a cohesive plot line with two different actors playing brothers who never were before. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I will say this, whatever shortcomings the plot has, every single dollar spent by the producers is up there on the screen.
Oh, my God. There were at least three long musical numbers that switched from era to era to era.
Yes.
And that doesn't even count the on-location filming that they did in the Canary Islands on, you know, in the desert scenes. I don't even know. They must have had access to some kind of MGM-like stock costume and set place where these things were available. I can't imagine the money you would spend otherwise.
Well, I've said this before about the Cliff Richard musicals. They are kind of a hybrid of a typical Elvis movie and an MGM musical from the golden age of Hollywood. Because you've got that rock and pop element, but your leading man is not only going to rock and pop, but he's also going to tap dance and maybe tango or do some kind of elaborate choreography or sing songs that would be more similar to what you'd see in a Gene Kelly movie. So what did you think of Cliff Richard as a leading man?
He's good. He's a good dancer. I did not realize that he would be such a good dancer. So that was exciting and fun, considering there were also so many dance scenes in it.
Right.
You know, he's very smooth. He's very attractive. He's got a great charisma on stage. He's pulling off a lot of ridiculous things with sincerity, which isn't easy to do. So I was impressed. I thought that, you know, he held his own against Mr. Slezak. I can't remember his first name, but
Walter Slezak.
Walter Slezak, yeah. Who plays the director, who's a, you know, storied actor, much older than him. You know, he holds the screen very well with him. I think it's great.
And what did you think of Cliff's chemistry with his co-star, Susan Hampshire?
I didn't love that. I didn't love her. I wanted to see more of the secondary woman, Una.
Oh, okay.
She was featured in one of the dance numbers, but she didn't have a lot of singing parts. But I really liked her energy and her charisma. I think, though, that was probably not the actor's fault as much as the character was always very sad and very shy.
Mm.
Her whole thing was, I don't have any confidence in myself.
Well, you must have picked up on something, because Cliff and Una Stubbs became fast friends. In fact, in the 70s, Cliff had a TV variety show, and Una Stubbs was his co-star on that. And they did a lot of production numbers and dancing on that show.
Yeah, the two of them were great together, and their dance number really reminded me of some of the things that were on Broadway at that time, like some of the Fosse shows, like Damn Yankees would have a number that was very, very similar to just the one All Kinds of People.
Yeah, well, let's get into it. As we talk about each song on this album, we'll talk a little bit more about the film, because I don't think there's any way to really separate the two. Let's begin with the main title theme, which I guess the most surprising thing about this is that it's not written by Peter Myers and Ronald Cass, who did most of the musical theater numbers, but instead it's written by Bruce Welch and Brian Bennett of The Shadows. What did you think of Wonderful Life?
It's a wonderful life. Fish in the sea, all born to be free. Yes, they all agree, it's a wonderful life. All over the world, in the heart of each boy and girl, you will find treasure there waiting to be.
It really started off that movie with a bang. You know, it's got this early 60s MGM style movie magic orchestra, the backing vocals. You know, it reminded me a lot of an Andy Williams Christmas song, of all things. And I think Cliff has a similar lilt to his voice as Andy Williams does, and the orchestrations were you know, in that same kind of universe. I really liked it. It drew you into the movie. It kind of brought you out of your world and into theirs, and being in their world is very important to enjoying this movie.
True. It's funny you mentioned go ahead. I was just gonna say, it's funny you mentioned Christmas, because about 10 times in this song they sing It's a Wonderful Life, and I kept making that connection to Christmas because of the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, maybe that's why I kept thinking about Christmas. I didn't even think about that, but absolutely, because there's nothing on the screen that was Christmassy at all,
right?
I mean, the song was great. I think that the Shadows songs are a little bit different. You know, you can always kind of pick up on when it's not written by Myers and Cass. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Shadows songs are a little bit more, they have a little bit more depth in them. And I feel like the orchestrations and, you know, because the Shadows are instrumentalists first and foremost, I think they pay a lot of attention to the non-singing parts of the songs too, and they feel a bit fuller than what the rest of it is.
Interesting. All right, track two on the album. This is the first big production number in what is a series of production numbers loosely tied together by, in your words, a bonkers plot. A Girl in Every Port. This was recorded in May of 64. This is a Cass and Meyer number, and this one wouldn't sound out of place in a musical like On the Town.
That's exactly what I wrote. It was like the adventure song in a musical like that, like New York, New York would have been that.
There's a girl in every port, takes your eye passing by on some street.
follow her, follow her, follow her. She may be the girl you always dreamed you'd meet. There's a girl in every part with a smile and a style of her own.
It had a very American feeling to me, too. Those are really songs that end up in American musical theater much more than British musical theater, especially then. It had both a sweeping quality, kind of like the first number, but also very frenetic. I noticed that the orchestrations, at one point, it almost sounded like Flight of the Bumblebee. It was so fast, and it was so counterpoint to what the other things were going on. It was extreme energy, which I think you need for the character of this movie. And, you know, I don't know, but what is it about 60s and their orchestrations and the xylophones? There's always a xylophone. Always.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Well, it lets us know that kookiness is afoot. I mean, at one point, they even reenact scenes from West Side Story in this.
That, wow. I mean, that whole section from the Al Jolson blackface to the West Side Story to, I mean, it took you on a journey.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. So that brings us to an instrumental, which is heard, I think, briefly in the movie, if that. It's a nifty instrumental by The Shadows called Walkin', written by Bruce Hank and Brian Bennett. It probably would have been better served as an album cut for The Shadows because, like I said, it's hardly even in this movie. And I think it's better than that. You know, I think it's better than how it's used.
I mean, I think that's a strength of The Shadows always. You don't necessarily need the lead vocalist to make the song a complete song. And I don't think a lot of pop bands can do that.
Even a snippet can be memorable. So the next cut on side one is A Little Imagination. This was recorded on April 22nd, 1964. This is of a similar ilk as another Cliff song from a movie, Nothing's Impossible from The Young Ones. One of these songs where, hey, if we put our mind to it, we can do anything. I really enjoy this. I'm actually surprised some other singer like a Michael Bublé or something hasn't come along and recorded a version of this because it's that good. And I think Cliff's performance here is really what sells it.
With a little imagination, you will find the world can be left behind. Life can be delicious with wishes in your mind. With a little imagination, you can be the one to make history. And though you're small, you feel tall as a poplar tree. And with your magic carpet, you can be.
Yeah, the song is kind of swinging and he's kind of crooning. It's a perfect combination there. And they have all of these opportunities to sing and dance and to switch in and out of these lavishly designed sets with great lavish costumes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're on a boat, they're in a Regency dance, you know, they're in a tango scene. They must have had a lot of fun with that. And I think that the movie soundtrack is much longer than the soundtrack.
Yes.
Every time they switch styles, they switch musical styles too, but they kept the same basic tenets of the song. So you were hearing the same short tune in, I don't know, 10, 12 different styles.
Mm-hmm. And next up on side one, another Myers and Cass number with the ABS Orchestra, a song called Home. And to your point, a lot of the songs on this album are re-records of the movie version. So the movie version is a little different than the soundtrack album version. And this song, I think, exists to give Cliff and Richard O'Sullivan and Melvin Hayes an opportunity to do a little soft shoe, really. I think that's mm-hmm. the only reason this song was written. And it reminds me of something that could have come from a musical. I don't know if you're familiar with it, called Me and My Girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's one of these kind of, I mean, at one point they slip into Cockney accents. I mean, it's cute, though. I like it.
And
rumble on down underground.
Hold tight.
Mind the doors, please. There's nothing quite the same as London town, especially when the rain is pouring down.
With something warm inside, the rain can't drown.
H-ho and he-o.
It's a cute little soft shoe. I mean, this is a moment in a lot of musicals. Certainly, Me and My Girl. I thought of the musical Once Upon a Mattress. You know, a lot of opportunities for the leading guy with the dancing ability to show off a little bit. And, you know, again, some fun orchestrations. There was some nice brass thrown in there. Don't forget, too, that it's a mirage. So
yes,
just, in the movie, it's not actually even real.
Right.
It's just even more, one more layer of bonkersness, well, in this movie.
Cliff and the Shadows and also Susan Hampshire have all said the same thing, where they love the production value of the movie and there are certainly entertaining parts of it, but none of them had any idea what the plot was while they were filming it.
Did they?
And it just seemed to be cobbled together. And mm-hmm. I like a lot about the movie Wonderful Life, but I think where it is seen as second rate compared to Summer Holiday and The Young Ones, I think both of those movies have some heart to them, whereas I don't think Wonderful Life really does. I mean, the heart is in the zest for life, you know, you see in the performances, but not necessarily in the story. So that's kind of a drawback. Anyway, moving on this side one of the soundtrack album, the first legitimate hit rock song from this movie, which is On the Beach, written by Hank, Bruce, and Cliff, supplying lyrics. This was recorded actually earlier than a lot of the other tracks on here, November 5th, 1963. It got all the way to number 7. And if you listen closely, there's a subtle nod to the Beatles on this track because they reference Twist and Shout.
Yeah, twist and shout now. You can do the dance that you want to with anyone that you meet. And if the bossa nova doesn't get you, the twist will have you on your feet. On the beat.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was Twist and Shout or if it was La Bamba. I couldn't tell. But they did say Twist and Shout at some point, so I figured it was probably that.
Yeah, and it's a cute sequence on the beach. You know, a lot of this stuff on the beach, it kind of reminds me of High School the Musical or Glee or something like that, where we're just bursting into song and everybody's, you know, dancing. The song is so successful that Cliff also recorded a German and an Italian version of the song.
I'm not surprised. It feels like the song that would be marketed as the standalone song that would be, you know, the focal point of the movie. The fact that the movie really doesn't have anything to do with anything that happens in the song is probably why, you know, some of the actors were confused and annoyed by the way it turned out. You know, there isn't a through line and the main song, you know, the main song doesn't really have any relevance to anything else that happens in the film, which is unusual. It's unusual for sure. But, you know, it's carefree. It's fun. You know, there's no more quintessential 60s thing than a beach party musical. So it's very exciting to see that catchy, great harmonies. You know, I can see why they recorded it in multiple languages.
And then we get to a ballad. This is the first real big ballad of the movie. It's called In the Stars, written by Peter Myers and Ron Cass. It's this big, sweeping, orchestral, lush love song. It's a duet in the film, but on the soundtrack album, it's just a solo number. I really like this. I could hear Sinatra singing a song like this.
Destiny, our paths lie closer than a hand is to its glove. It was in the stars that we should love.
I think it works better as a solo number. I think it's kind of meh in the movie itself, but it comes to life when it's just him. I think that they had to do that for the movie, but yeah, it wasn't a high point. I think one high point visually though in the movie is that they were filming it with, you know, state of the art filming technology at the time, which was, I think, called Technoscope. And it, that technology that allowed for a very wide zoom shots. And this is one of those scenes where they took so much advantage of their new toy. They had lots of zoom shots, the two of them, you know, far back with this desert, these hills and sands. And, you know, it was a really beautiful scene.
So that ends side one of the soundtrack album. We flip this record over, and again, it's another Myers and Cass number. Along with the ABS Orchestra, it's We Love a Movie, and this is a song that shares similar DNA with Hooray for Hollywood, There's No Business Like Show Business, Make 'Em Laugh. It's not as good as any of those kind of songs, but it's in that wheelhouse.
We shout no when the star of the show leaves them flat on the opening day. We gasp, oh. From the chorus back row comes a kid who knows all of the play. What romance! See her sing, see her dance. She's a star who's beginning to climb. For it's a movie, yeah! We love a movie, give us a movie every time.
Hooray for Hollywood! That's gooey, bally, hooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases the tired businessman.
Hooray for Hollywood!
Yeah, and it's cute. It's kind of vaudevillian, and it does. It calls back to all of those other things. Annie, Gypsy, you know, all the musicals you mentioned. There's just so many where let's make a show or let's celebrate performance is the central point of the movie. And those are always fun to see young, excited, pretty actors being young, exciting, pretty actors. So, and this is where they put in that history of film. Mm-hmm. So that was a very long part. I was wondering, I noticed that there was huge discrepancies between the UK release of this movie and the US release, not only in the name, but that it was about a half an hour shorter in the US. Was this what they cut?
I don't know. I mean, it's probably for the best because I could easily hack 30 minutes out of this and it would work. I'm not sure. I've never seen the U.S. cut. I've only, because the U.S. cut is called Swingers Paradise, I think.
Yeah, very risque name.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Who knows what that's all about? But yeah, maybe they did cut this. Maybe they would, although this would have been the sequence that probably would have appealed to Americans most, because you've got them doing the Marx Brothers and
yeah, it's mostly American film that they
yeah
they
except
go
for
over.
The James Bond bit at the end. I do want to point out that this is a movie where you're starting to see they're using the shadows more as characters in the movie. In the previous two films, the shadows are kind of there. Or like Cliff will show up at a club and the shadows just happen to be there and they'll sing. But here the shadows are with Cliff, but they're not main characters. We still have these two other guys, Melvin Hayes and Richard O'Sullivan. I asked, when I interviewed Bruce Welch, I asked him about that. Why weren't the shadows just Cliff's pals in the movie? And they said it's because we couldn't act. So that was the reason.
I mean, it made sense, you know, in almost any musical comedy, you're going to have the ensemble and you're going to have the two people that are like the comedy leads in the ensemble. So
yes.
I guess that's what these two guys were. Were they with Cliff for other movies? They're really
yes.
funny together.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Next up, we have a ballad written by Bruce and Hank called Do You Remember? This is the only song on this album that wasn't specifically written for the film. This was actually recorded, well, a version of it was recorded in 1961, but never used.
Do you remember the first time that we kissed? Do you remember it was on a night like this? The stars above.
So it was dusted off and included in the film. In the movie version, it's a duet with Susan Hampshire on the Wonderful Life soundtrack album. It's just Cliff singing with the group.
Stars were up above, a boy and girl in love, sitting in our lover's midst, planning, scheming, hoping and dreaming, from the first time that we kissed. Yes, I remember as I drew you near.
I'm not surprised that you say that it was recorded a few years earlier, because it had this callback to 50s songs, like, you know, like Teenager in Love. It kind of felt like that. And Cliff was kind of at his crooniest crooner sound when he sang it, too. So it was a little bit, yeah, it was a little bit out of like, oh, that's different. Not in a bad way, but certainly felt very 50s to me. I noticed, too, that it was the first time of two that the Nori Paramore strings were mentioned.
Oh.
Yeah. So when was it that that string group was playing as opposed to the ABS orchestra or anybody else? Because there's so much orchestration in this musical.
My guess would be that the Nori Paramore orchestra is playing on the November 63 sessions.
Okay, got it.
Next up on side two, another song written by Bruce and Hank. This one's called What Have I Got to Do? And this is cut from the same cloth as Dancing Shoes in Summer Holiday. I feel like it's placed in kind of the same spot in both movies. But I do feel that, and this is a good song. I mean, I don't think it's as good as Dancing Shoes, but I feel like this song was written so that we could have a scene of Cliff and Eunice Dubs dancing together, really.
Which is not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all.
What have I got to do?
I mean, I don't know how many times I can say that a song feels a little bit out of place without just saying that all the songs feel very different. But this one, again, and not in the same way as the last song, this kind of sounded like almost a Monkees song.
Yes.
Or, you know, like, whereas Do You Remember felt like it was a few years past, this one felt very of the moment. Like, it felt a lot like the Monkees, or like what the Beatles were doing during the Help era. It almost had like a honky-tonk piano going. It was... It was fun. It was different. And I think it maybe took you out of the vibe of the movie a bit because it was so different. But I liked that feel, that callback to like, this is actually 1964, you know, and this is the sound of the moment.
And then we get to another Shadows instrumental called Theme for Young Lovers, which was released as a single. In fact, this, I guess, would be the first single from this album. This was recorded in those November 63 sessions. In the film, we don't hear this version. We don't hear the Shadows perform it. It's just a piece of orchestral music. But I like this. I mean, you know, this is a... Bruce Welch is really responsible for at least half of these songs.
Yeah, here. Definitely. Do you know anything about the process of writing this and how the songwriting was split up?
There seems to be a formula in place already. It started with the Young Ones, but you have Myers and Cass writing the musical theater songs that move the plot along, in this case, whatever plot there is. And Bruce and the rest of the Shadows are writing for the teenage market. You mentioned this next song earlier. It's a Myers and Cass extravaganza, and that's really the only word you can say for it, because when you hear this song, you can just envision, even if you hadn't seen Wonderful Life, you could just envision the entire cast, like maybe a West End show or a Broadway show, all getting out there and singing and dancing. I mean, this is, in a film with a lot of production numbers, this is the big production number.
We'll dance together, it is true,
but must work together too, if we want future that is love.
Yeah, this was great. I mean, this was so of the moment with, like I said, like Damn Yankees and the Pajama Game. Bob Fosse was doing this right down to the black mock turtlenecks and pedal pushers they were all wearing. I mean, it was just so similar. And the dancing was incredible. I mean, this is one where Una Stubbs really shined dancing next to Cliff. They had so much chemistry. The song itself was cute. And I mean, that's a song about like diversity and teamwork that could be used today. I mean, that message is something that a lot of people are interested in spreading still. And it was upbeat. It was fun. You know, it kind of got back to what I think are the roots of this movie, which is that let's make a show, movie, musical that so many people have, you know, emulated, but they wanted to, you know, elevate it quite a bit. But there is that core there. And this is one of those songs that really, you know, kind of nails you down to that core. And I loved this one. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it's a really good number. Then we get to a song written by Bruce Welch from those November 63 sessions. To me, this is the big ballad of the movie. In much the same way, The Next Time is the big ballad of Summer Holiday. A Matter of Moments is just a classic song, a classic performance, great vocals by Cliff. The band sounds great. You just can't beat it.
In a matter of moments, in a matter of moments. In a matter of moments, in a matter of moments.
I fell in love.
In a matter of moments, in a matter of moments.
In a matter of moments. And the world was mine. And the world was mine.
This was a popular song outside of this movie, right?
Yeah, it was the flip side of On the Beach, so it had a lot of exposure.
Yeah, because I felt like I knew this one just being alive. I knew this one pretty well. But it's beautiful. The harmony, again, something about the orchestral arrangement. I don't know if it kind of harkens back again to that Andy Williams Carpenters sort of feeling, which I always really enjoy. Again, it felt a little bit different from whatever in my mind is the rest of the score. But, you know, I think I'm saying that so many times that it really doesn't mean anything anymore.
But it's kind of like the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's what this movie does to you.
It all lives in its own world, and you just have to get with the program.
Well, here we are at the last track on the album, and this is the song where everything comes together. As you alluded to, the two movies shot simultaneously somehow are put together. Cliff Richard, Walter Slezak, together. Although not really, because on the album, this song, Youth and Experience, it's Cliff and one of the singers from the Mike Sam Singers doing it.
I don't know
if Walter Slezak lip-synced in the movie, but whatever the case, that's not him here. This is okay. You know, it's kind of anticlimactic after All Kinds of People. You'd kind of think that would be the big one to go out on.
You're so wild.
You're so square.
You're a child.
You're getting silver hair.
But when something's to be done, it takes youth and experience to really fire the gun.
You know, you got to end the show somewhere.
And
ending it at the movie premiere, I guess, you know, that's a natural stopping point. Ending it at, oh, I hear you're going to be my son-in-law. Wait, what? I didn't know you were her father. That's an interesting place to end it. That was shocking. And then, okay, let's sweep all that under the rug and sing a song. That's great. That's great. the ridiculousness does not stop at the finale. You know, we start off with a pretty traditional sort of duet. You know, you see these duets between the young ingenue guy and the older man, like How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying has something like this. You know, it's kind of a trope. But then we get into the chorus moments. And in the film, at least, the first part of the chorus is sung by a theater full of entirely older people who don't understand the young. And then the second part is filled by a theater filled with entirely the UK equivalent of Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts who don't understand the older people. Right, where those people, right. How they decided that was okay to, you know, just insert that in. I don't know where that came from, because there was not a Boy Scout or Girl Scout in that audience otherwise.
Well, this was a hit film. I mean, this finished in the top 10 for the year. But just a few days later, the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night comes out. And there's a feeling, and you see it reflected in the literature around that time, that A Hard Day's Night comes out, and that represents a newer and fresher kind of movie. And Wonderful Life is instantly dated, or at the very least pales in comparison to A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, I mean, it most definitely exists in its own universe. But other than that part of it, this isn't that much different from the movie Help. I don't think that it's comparative to A Hard Day's Night. If anything, it's comparative to Help, or, you know, the Elvis movies, the Frankie and Annette movies. It's funny that people felt that this was out of step, because A Hard Day's Night was in black and white. This was in color. A Hard Day's Night was written in an older comedy style because the Beatles were such fans of like the Goon Show and that kind of comedy. This feels more up to date with the youth, you know what I mean? But whatever the formula, and it is A Hard Day's Night, it worked in a more enduring way that has kept that, given that the feeling of a classic movie, while some of these other ones feel very much of their time. And I'm including Help in that category. If you're comparing this to any Beatles movie, it's got to be to Help, because it feels so much of that time. Whereas A Hard Day's Night feels almost like it was a few years earlier.
Well, again, thank you so much for reviewing this album with me and watching the film.
Yes, that movie was definitely a lot, and I'm really glad to have experienced it. Thanks so much to David for having me on We Say Yeah and letting us play some of it here. We're definitely going to return the favor soon, because we totally need a Cliff and the Beatles episode here on BC The Beatles. You can find this full episode and way more about Cliff on the We Say Yeah feed, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be taking next week off, but we'll be back in 2 weeks' time discussing one of our favorite members of Brian's stable of artists, Cilla Black.
Until then, as always, subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening right now. Please, please give us a rating and review so other Beatlemaniacs can find us.
And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter/X, and TikTok. We'll be posting photos and more from this episode and beyond. And don't forget, you can always email us at bcthebeatles@gmail.com. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.